Welcome to the global phenomenon, Surviving the Survivor, where we bring you the best guests in all of true crime. Here's your host, Emmy Award-winning journalist, Joel Waldman.
What's up, SDS Nation, and welcome to another episode of Surviving the Survivor. It is the podcast that brings you the very best guests in all of true crime, and today, among the best of the best here. I'm sure you recognize at least a couple of them, but we're going to be talking about accused healthcare CEO assassin Luigi Mangione. He's facing both federal and state charges. I think it is 11 counts in all, including murder as an act of terrorism and in the state of New York, first degree murder, which is rather rare. Raises some complex legal questions about due process, public bias, things of this nature. Without further ado, best guest, Joe Petuto. She joined the faculty of the University of Nebraska in 1974. She teaches federal jurisdiction, constitutional law, sports law, crim pro, as they say. She's taught everywhere at other schools, and she is our go-to here. She is the professor emerita. Randy Zellin, coming to us looking a little relaxed on a much-needed vacation. He is a New York City-based former prosecutor turned criminal defense attorney, more than 30 years of experience. He's tried cases against both the DOJ and the SEC. He's also an adjunct professor at Cornell, even though he's wearing a Harvard shirt today. I hope Cornell doesn't know that. And he's appeared on many different media outlets, the Fox Newses, the Fox Businesses, CNNs, etc. And then the man we call R, Timothy Jansen, the letter R and the O-U-R. He's the famed Tallahassee criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. If you look behind him, he's got a gazillion nutcrackers. Tim Jansen has the biggest Christmas party in Tallahassee, and it's tonight. Tim, what time is everyone coming over?
7. I've got like 20 minutes. I'm hiding from my wife.
Perfect. We're here to help and assist.
We're here to aid and abet.
Randy, let me start with you while we're hiding Tim. First of all, it's unusual. We're going to get the video, I hope, but this was a federal hearing, and then they released video of it, which you almost never see. So why are we seeing it today, Randy?
It's hard to say. This case presents such an outlier on so many different levels. It's almost hard for me as a criminal defense attorney to separate myself as a human being. As a criminal defense attorney, I've got to be cool, dispassionate, objective, look at the evidence, look at the lack of evidence, and formulate a defense. As a citizen, I am mortified, to quote, I guess, almost that Seinfeld episode, I am mortified and stupefied. It is beyond my ability to comprehend how this young man can be hailed as a hero. He assassinated a human being. Cold blood, it was not even cold blood. Shooting him in the back with a silencer.
Yeah.
It is beyond my ability to comprehend how this young man, who was apparently given everything you could possibly want for as far as a life of a child, given everything that you could possibly ask for to succeed. And that maybe is where mental illness is going to kick in. And Karen Agnifilo, who is a tremendously talented defense lawyer, I'm sure is thinking about that as much as she said so on CNN before she got the case. But as a citizen, how this young man is hailed as some kind of a hero or is martyrized, I think that's part of the reason why the Southern District came in and basically said, all right, everybody, slow your roll here. The big boys and the big girls are in town now, and we're going to take the emotion and the drama and the feel good about this, and we're going to give you the cold, hard facts, which is this man, this young man, is going to be faced with being executed.
Yeah. By the way, Karen Friedman Agnifilo, who is the husband of Sean Diddy's Mark Agnifilo's attorney, who, by the way, he was in court, which we'll get to. But she's tough, man. And she told the judge and the prosecutors that she's putting everybody on notice. She's not happy about the way things have been carried out. But Tim Jansen, the overarching question on the thumbnail, which I was going to say, but since you have limited time before you're the the host with the host, as Carm would say, the hostess with the mostest, but you're the host with the most. is Luigi Mangione, in your opinion, being overcharged? Federal counts, state counts, terrorism charges. Are they making more of this? I mean, it's what Randy just said. This is a guy who's murdered in cold blood, but from a legal perspective, is it being overcharged, do you think?
It's not overcharged because the federal charges are warranted. There's elements for the charges. It's a serious charge. They have no faith in the state system. They have no faith in the state prosecution. When you're hearing people calling him a hero, he shot him with a silencer in the back. That's horrible. This guy is not a hero. He's the worst of the worst. He's not even a vigilante. Remember we saw the shows on the vigilante would kill people who are committing crimes. This health executive worked his way up. It wasn't like he's some rich guy just, you know, didn't know how to help and learn the company. He was the CEO, and by all respects, he was trying to change things. But to kill him in cold blood the way he did, travel the way he did, these charges are warranted. I don't care who his lawyer is. He'll get due process. He'll get zealous representation. But he's going to spend at least the rest of his life in prison. And anybody considers that a hero needs to rethink their morals. This guy is not a hero. It could be your loved one, your family member he shot and killed. Would he be a hero then?
Yeah. By the way, we're going to get to it. There were pro-Free Luigi people outside the courtroom. Women showed up in court today. I'm going to give you the details of that in a moment. Nikki Cuds, my friend of the show, was at my mother's assisted living today. People were talking about Mangione as if he did the right thing. I mean, none of you are psychologists, I know that, but Joe Petuto, you taught young people who are idealistic. That's what you did your whole life. This guy took it a step too far. What do you think of these people that are now, praising him? There's a Twitter/X account that honors him. What do you make of that?
Well, in the first place, I think there's a fringe out there that would support anything. And you see them arise no matter what the legal story is, no matter what the public story is. And I think some of it will dissipate or at least mute as some more information comes out as to what happened. At least I hope so. I want to say I agree with everything that Randy said and certainly everything that Tim said with one exception. I do not think the federal charges are warranted. Federal jurisdiction is described as interstitial in nature. It covers, it backs up state systems, and particularly in the criminal area, the states are the primary repository of criminal jurisdiction. And this case, to say it's you have to have a federal connection. To say it's a federal connection because he crossed state lines to get to New York, or because he used a cell phone or the internet that goes across lines, would mean that virtually every run-of-the-day murder in New York or Florida or anywhere else could be a federal case. And I think that is such an unwarranted attempt to expand federal jurisdiction. And I think if there were to be a federal prosecution and there were to be a conviction, I would give it even odds that it would be reversed on the fact that the federal government exceeded its authority under the U.S. Constitution. I just think it's, you said, are there too many? Are they amping up? I think on the state side, I would say they're amping up. I mean, I think theoretically, technically, on the terrorism charge as it's defined in state law, it fits, but it doesn't fit perfectly. It doesn't fit beautifully, if I can use that word. And it opens up the state prosecution to all kinds of things they don't need to have in their trial. Because this business of him being, you know, a martyr to the insurance profession, being the, you know, the spokesperson, the very things that he's being lauded for in the public right now, if you put in a terrorism charge, opens up the evidence to bring in things that I think otherwise wouldn't come in. There would make it a case that no longer is the case that Tim talked about and that Randy really talked about eloquently, which is This is a cold-blooded murder, shooting somebody in the back with a silencer. So anyway. Yeah.
Well, Randy, the professor has spoken, and now the pupil must answer, Randy. She called you out.
And I'm sitting here thinking about an appropriate response, and a couple of things come to my mind. I do, to a degree, agree that the federal charges, to the extent that they are based solely upon interstate travel, Mr. Mangione having traveled from whether it was Hawaii or Pennsylvania, wherever he came from, he was not in New York. He was not living in New York. He did not wake up in his New York apartment that he had been living in for some years and then stood outside of the New York Hilton and shot Mr. Thompson. So, yes, it is solely based upon the traveling of the state lines. And I also agree that the Southern District stepped in for a reason, and I think that reason is that Alvin Bragg, as talented, and people lose sight of the fact that Alvin Bragg happens to be Harvard educated, like my t-shirt, very bright, a talented prosecutor, but he's damaged goods now. He's damaged goods because of bail reform, which quite frankly isn't his fault, because that's a statute in New York that allows judges just to free people. You can't even have a conversation about bail. That's not Bragg's fault. But he's the prosecutor, so it's on his watch. His handling of the Trump prosecution and the politicalization of that case has really damaged Alvin Bragg's credibility. And perhaps now he's trying to redeem himself by loading up on Mr. Mangione, because let's face it, to the professor's point, second degree murder on this case, you could try this case in a coma and beat Mr. Mangione on the second degree murder. The first degree murder to me, I'll tell you something that strikes me, which is that the first degree murder charge almost says to everybody else, you're not as important. Your loved one who died, that's only second degree murder. What Mangione did, that's first degree murder. So what he did in Mr. Thompson's life is more important than your sons or your daughters or your husbands, because there really is no difference. There's no difference. This is truly a terrorism case. You cannot you cannot liken Mr. Mangione to Osama bin Laden or to Sheikh Khalid Mohammed. It's not a terrorism case in the classic sense. Yes, did it scare people? The funny thing is, we're all talking about it. It didn't scare a lot of people. It apparently has energized people. He has been lionized. I would almost submit that the reverse has happened here. This was not terrorism. This has been a call to arms against the insurance company, the insurance industry. It's sickening. It's sick. And it's not even. And as much as I will go out on a limb, it's not as if Mr. Mangione had a daughter, had a son, and that infant, the insurance company United said, nope, you're not getting extra time in the NIC unit, you're not getting the medication that you need, and the child died. Then maybe you could understand some insane act by a father who just couldn't breathe anymore. Maybe his wife ended up committing suicide as a result of the loss of the child, and the man just snapped. None of that is here in this case. This manifesto that he wrote, to me, is the reason why the Southern District said, we're not taking any chances with this one. This one's going down, and this one's going down the right way.
You know what?
So my response to Joe is, Joe, we have expanded federal jurisdiction for years. Possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. Indeed. Drug cases. Possession of child porn. We have always expanded federal jurisdiction based on interstate nexus. Right?
Indeed, but this one takes it. If the only nexus you need is a defendant crossing a state line, you have now opened the door to federalizing every single state crime that isn't entirely local within the state. And if you add using the internet, you've expanded beyond that. I think it's an absolutely understandable, I take Randy's point, but I think it's an absolutely indefensible expansion of federal jurisdiction and intrusion into state sovereignty.
Well, you know, some state jurisdictions don't have the ability to prosecute certain cases. That's why the feds have to do it. They don't have the manpower, they have the resources.
Huh? This isn't one of them. It's an easy murder case, and New York has a lot of money.
But, you know, that doesn't mean the feds don't have jurisdiction. And I understand your point, but I don't think the appellate court would throw it out based on that.
There may be something else going on here, which is with the romanticizing of Luigi Mangione. Imagine this case being televised in a New York state court. That ain't going to happen in a federal court.
No,
all you're going to get in New York federal courtroom sketches.
Yeah, no, I'll stand by. This is one where I'm going to stake my little foot in the ground and not move. It's, you know, this is it's an inappropriate expansion. And in fact, the federal government has a policy with regard to this. And this one strikes me as violating their own policy.
I'll be right out.
So, Tim has to go. He's got to go celebrate Christmas.
All right, I got to go. I just
Merry Christmas.
I got to jump.
Yeah, Merry Christmas.
Happy holiday.
Happy holiday. All right, have a good time, Tim. Say hello to everyone.
I will say that the difference, because I looked at some of the procedure in state and federal court, and if I've got it right, if she decides to plead insanity, which on that TV show she was before she was hired, she was talking about as maybe the viable defense or the only viable defense, insanity is harder to... It's harder to be able to successfully plead insanity in a federal court because the burden is even higher. It's clear and convincing evidence, not a preponderance. And the standard is higher. It's did not. Whereas in the state court, it's substantially lost the substantial.
And as long as we're talking differences in law, there is a wide divide in discovery. These days, under New York State discovery, prosecutors almost immediately upon indictment have to open their kimono, open their skirts, open the desk, open everything. Discovery is just back up a trailer to defense counsel's office and start unloading discovery right on down to the disciplinary history of the police officers. You get everything and you get everything immediately, whereas under federal rules of criminal procedure, and in particular Rule 16, you still got to ask for it. You're going to get very limited discovery. The judge isn't going to make the government turn anything over more than Rule 16 mandates. You're not going to get a bill of particulars, and you're only going to hope that you have a prosecutor who is secure enough to bring you into a conference room and say, what do you want to know? But technically, Karen is going to have far less discovery at her disposal in the Southern District than she's going to get in Manhattan Supreme Court.
By the way, the COE who is the chief of everything. My wife, first it was Tim's wife, now it's my wife, telling me to play the sound. But what is amazing, when you have three, but now two criminal defense attorneys, and you are hosting a show, you literally just have to say hello. And the job is taken care of for you, especially when one is an Italian from New Jersey and the other is a Jewish guy from New York. I could let the two go on for like 7.5 hours here, but I will referee a little bit. So there you go. Good debate right there. This is sound from earlier today. This is Karen Friedman, Agnifilo. And let's take a listen.
The people have had this case for about almost three weeks, and that's more than enough time to gather as much information as they can give to us, especially now that we have two proceedings that we have to answer to, one of them being death eligible. So we are requesting that we get immediate discovery of the New York City Police Department and FBI and federal and state documents. And the second thing I want to make a record of, Your Honor, is I'm very concerned about my client's right to a fair trial in this case. He's being prejudiced by some statements that are being made by government officials. Like every other defendant, he's entitled to a presumption of innocence. But unfortunately, the way this has been handled so far, his rights are being violated. And as you know, Your Honor, there's a wealth of case law guaranteeing his right to a fair trial. But none of the safeguards have been put in place yet here. In fact, it's just the opposite of what's been happening. He's a young man, and he is being treated like a human ping pong ball between two warring jurisdictions here. These federal and state prosecutors are coordinating with one another, but at the expense of him. They have conflicting theories in their indictments, and they are literally treating him like he is like some sort of political fodder, like some sort of spectacle. He was on display for everyone to see in the biggest staged perp walk I've ever seen in my career. It was absolutely unnecessary. He's been cooperative with law enforcement. He had been in custody for over a week. He waived extradition. He was cooperative at all accounts. There was no reason for the NYPD and everybody to have these big assault rifles that, frankly, I had no idea it was in their arsenal. That, and to have all of these the press there, the media there, it was like,
I'm going to stop. That's like halfway through this bite. We've got another one. So it's a lengthy bite. But Randy, number one, do you know her? Do you know her personally? Or do you know Mark?
I know both of them.
Yeah. So let me ask you this. Why did they call her and Mark, not you? Because you're a very formidable defense attorney. What's going on with this couple right now? They're becoming like the New York power couple.
Mark is born and raised, as much as there is apparently a rift between the two of them. He comes out of the Ben Brafman School of Lawyering. He worked under Ben. He worked alongside my other friend, Alex Spiro. So Mark, his chops, his credentials coming out of Ben's office are really unmatched. Karen, number two in the Manhattan DA's office, the very office that is now prosecuting her client. He was... he could not do better. She was a natural. Knowing that office, as people have said, she knows where the pencils are stored. She knows where the dust mops are in the Manhattan DA's office. So what you're really talking about here is, if you're going to be defending a high-profile case in New York City, particularly in Manhattan Supreme Court being prosecuted by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, You really can't do better than Karen. And Mark and Karen right now are both at the top of their game. So I don't think anyone would question whether or not that was a wise choice.
Yeah. It's interesting because Mark, I read, joined her in court this morning, which seems a little unusual. Why would that be? And obviously you got the state and federal charges. Is she representing them on both fronts right now?
I believe that she is, and she is counsel to Mark's new firm at Niffolo and Tratter, so there was nothing weird. Certainly Mark's appearance alongside her was in no way, shape, or form some signal that Karen needs help here. It's a firm matter, and it's being treated as a firm matter, and there are many instances where a firm will send two attorneys in on the defense. And quite frankly, just about every government prosecution at a federal level, there are always two assistants. And in addition to the two assistants, there is the case agent. So there are typically three people at the government's counsel table in a federal case. So there's no raised eyebrows here over the fact that Mark joined Karen in court. This is one of the highest profile cases in Manhattan right now, and they are defending the case properly, and quite frankly, they are putting the right soldiers in place to do the case.
Yeah. Joe Picciuto, people were commenting today, because it is a little odd if you look, attorney and client are in matching outfits. So I'm wondering what you make of that. There's anything to make of that. And also, this is, I don't think this was live. If I'm correct, it was released by a single camera after the proceedings, I believe. But you never see a camera in a New York City courtroom. So how do you justify this? And what's, Sean Diddy Combs, you know, we haven't seen Cameron there. It seems like there are separate rules for this particular case, Joel, this is in state court.
So in Manhattan, in state court, you can have cameras. This is not the federal court proceeding.
Yeah. Well, okay. I mean, but we typically don't, right, Randy? Correct me if I'm wrong.
You started the Trump case. You saw before things were happening, and you can have cameras. You don't have the prohibition in state court in Manhattan like you do in federal court, where it's absolutely prohibited.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you clarified
that. That makes your point, Joel. I think Trump, this case, they don't typically do it. This case is being treated differently. I think it would be hard to dispute. The mayor doesn't come out, you know, with a typical arrest.
That was ridiculous. For Adams to be part of the perp walk and to meet him at the helicopter, that was horrifying. That was called Mayor Adams saying, forget about the fact that I'm under indictment in the Southern District and look at me as the concerned mayor.
That's right. I'm law and order, except for my case.
I'll tell you what he said to Luigi Mangione. It's been revealed, but let's watch the rest. It's about another minute and a half or so on this soundbite.
Perfectly choreographed. And what was the New York City mayor doing at this press conference? That just made it utterly political. And as Your Honor knows, under Lauro v. Charles, the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit has held it to be clearly established that these staged perp walks to the media, unrelated to a legitimate law enforcement objective, is unconstitutional. And I submit there was zero law enforcement objective to do that sort of perp walk. There's absolutely no need for that whatsoever. And frankly, Your Honor, the mayor should know more than anyone about the presumption of innocence that he too is afforded when he dealing with his own issues. And frankly, I submit that he was just trying to detract from those issues by making a spectacle of Mr. Mangione, and there are consequences to this. He has a right to a fair trial, and I just want to put on the record statements that the mayor made publicly about my client. Nothing saying alleged, for example, and he said, I wanted to send a strong message with the police commissioner that we're leading from the front. I'm not going to just allow him to come into our city. I wanted to look him in the eye and state, you carried out this terrorist act in my city, in the city of New York that I love, and he wanted to show symbolism. Your Honor, he's not a symbol. He's somebody who is afforded the right to a fair trial. He's innocent until proven guilty. And the mayor was talking to jurors, future potential jurors that elected him. Those are the people that elected him that he is talking to and calling this man a terrorist. So, Your Honor, I just want to make a record of this and put everyone on notice that this has to stop. And my client is entitled to a fair trial and the presumption of innocence. And we're going to fight these charges, whether it's in the state or federal, to the fullest extent. Thank you, Your Honor.
Right there, Randy, I'm putting everyone on notice. She literally put everyone on notice. So this is the now infamous perp walk. Can't see Mayor Adams in that shot. But what do you make of her court demeanor there? Firm and serious.
Well, the demeanor was spot on. I think Karen, though, has to remember that having been a career prosecutor, I'll bet you she staged one or two perp walks in her time. But I do think that she was right. Again, Mayor Adams being part of that perp walk was so out of bounds, was so inappropriate, and it was so demeaning to every notion of our system of justice. It was grandstanding. It was take the heat off of my own personal case. Whoever told Mayor Adams that was a good idea, or whoever didn't tie him to a chair so he couldn't meet up with the helicopter and be part of that perp walk, I'm wondering whether or not he needs a wholesale changing of his staffing.
Yeah. Randy, is there anything to read into the similar, by the way, this is a guy who we really should be talking about, but in true crime, sadly, it's usually the suspect, not the victim. This is Brian Thompson, father of two, gunned down in cold blood on December 4th in Midtown Manhattan. But Randy, do you read anything into the quote unquote matching outfit? Someone in the chat said maybe they're trying to make him look like Eric Menendez. But is there anything
so much about? I don't know so much Eric Menendez, though. I see your point. I think it was more humanizing him, having him kind of look like his attorney makes him perhaps look less like a monster. Certainly, he benefited from not being in Prison Orange, as many defendants do, where you are so demonized and you just look guilty. There, he looked like he was going out to dinner, and the fact that they were both wearing matching burgundy sweaters really humanized him and made him look far less like a defendant because he looked like his attorney.
Yeah. By the way, Isigal Aksu comes to us, and this is her second super chat, so thank you so much. But which one knows better, reader or traveler? Type of great debate. An enlightening guest we trust. She comes to us from Turkey. Joe Petuto, to you, this is, I'm going to read it to you, what Mayor Eric Adams, who is in trouble himself with a bunch of indictments, a bunch of charges. He came out and publicly spoke to the media. He said, "I wanted to send a strong message about this perp walk with the police commissioner that we are leading from the front. I'm not going to just allow him," meaning Mangione, "to come into our city. I wanted to look him in the eye and state that," and he quotes himself, "you carried out this terrorist act in my city, the city that the people of New York love, and I wanted to be there to show the symbolism of that." I mean, it's a little rich with irony, but what do you make of that, Joe?
I think it's rich with irony, entirely inappropriate. And to the extent he's got constituents who think this guy is a hero, I'm not sure what his political calculus is right now. But in any event, he shouldn't have been there. He certainly shouldn't have been making statements that prejudge Mangione's guilt. I mean, I can't think of a reason to justify the mayor being there making the statements he did. Not one that's a legitimate, reasonable reason. I can think of some political reasons, but none that are defensible in terms of our system.
Yeah. Randy, one of the interesting things is, you know, we all saw that walk into the Pennsylvania courthouse where he kind of had a bit of a fit. You see the photo on the left where the deputy had to stick that thumb into his neck, which people were not happy with. But today, and you know, the New York Post is going to do this. I know they ran with it. I haven't seen many of the other newspapers. He was grinning. And so they're highlighting that. How careful does Karen Agnifilo need to be with him in terms of his court demeanor from this point? Because everyone's looking at him and everything is going to be, used in the court of public opinion.
We as defense attorneys are, Joel, as you just put it, we are literally directors of a play, directors of a movie. And we try to script everything out, whether it be what the client is wearing, when the client should appear to be taking notes or talking to counsel, because the jury, because the judge, because the public are watching every single thing that the defendant does. We script walking into court, walking out of court, leaving the court, walking on the street. You never know who's watching. I think, and again, this is just my own speculation, Mr. Mangione, for whatever the reason, does not appear to be someone who is easily controlled and necessarily takes direction, because what would have possessed him to grin? It's one thing in Pennsylvania. I don't know that he had counsel at that moment when he left the police vehicle, was walking into the station of the courthouse when he had that tirade. I'll give him a mulligan on that one. It's not represented by counsel, deer in the headlights, doesn't know what's going on. He lashes out. But it may very well be that he is not someone that is going to be controllable. And I don't know that those people who view him as a hero, that those grins, the smiling, at some point, I think the professor's point is well taken. The romanticism is going to fade. And he will be just another defendant. Someone else will come up. There'll be another high-profile case. There'll be something else for us to be looking at, as Karen said, like fodder, and we will forget about Luigi Mangione. But for the moment, we're not forgetting about him. The grin was not a good look. It was not a good move. The lashing out, not a good move. But again, for all we know, there could be a mental disease or defect case here, a defense here. It may be difficult. I know a lot of us talking heads have spoken about the difficulty in establishing an insanity defense when the basis of it is, I didn't understand what I was doing. I couldn't appreciate the nature of my actions. I couldn't tell the difference between right and wrong. Well, that's a tough one when you have someone planning, going to the hotel, writing a manifesto about it, buying a gun with a silencer, stalking the man, waiting for him outside, getting into an isosceles stance and shooting him in the back point blank, wearing a mask to and from, concealing his identity, leaving the state by bus to go to Pennsylvania, certainly went to great lengths to hide his identity, tried to map out some kind of an escape route that really flies in the face of any notion of, I didn't understand what I was doing and didn't recognize that I was doing the wrong thing and I couldn't tell the difference between right and wrong.
Yeah. By the way, a lot of people are commenting that regarding the outfit, it's made to look like mother and son, maybe to make him a little more, sympathetic to the public. Joe, to you from Robin, can you believe that his fans and influencers were posting where you can buy his sweater? I mean, insane. To that point, 24 women packed the courtroom today. That would be 24 women were in there, just 6 men. And then outside, there was at least 30 supporters chanting and holding signs. I was watching a reporter. You could barely hear what she was saying because everyone was chanting for Luigi. I know we've talked about this, but when you hear that they're posting where you can buy this sweater and women are filing into this courtroom, I mean, as a professor of law, it's got to bother you. I mean, as a human being, it's got to bother you.
Well, yeah, of course. I have no explanation for it. I have no explanation of women who marry first-degree murderers when they're sitting in prison. None of this behavior corresponds with anybody I know, or at least I think I know. And I've heard some of these people interviewed, and it doesn't make any sense to me when I hear them either. So I'm really the wrong person to ask because it's completely outside any frame of reference I have or I've ever had.
Randy, for those who don't know, what kind of explain what jury nullification is. The question is, can his lawyer somehow suggest the jury find Luigi not guilty?
Given the current climate, and again, I think this is part of the reason why the Southern District stepped in, and I know the professor doesn't agree, but I'm just calling balls and strikes right now. I think that there is a fear that in your garden variety Manhattan-based jury, or juror, or jury veneer, the panel, there could be one in there that is going to move heaven and earth to get into that box, be one of the 12, and will be the one holdout because the verdict has to be unanimous. But to answer your question, what is jury nullification? What jury nullification simply is, the judge instructs the jury on the law. And let's take something simple. Let's take an assault case. The judge instructs the jury, ladies and gentlemen, if you find that the defendant knowingly and intentionally, with the intention of hurting someone, hurt another person, then you must find the defendant guilty of assault. And let's say that the prosecution proves that on a certain day, I intended Joel to punch you in the face, and I punched you in the face, and I caused you to suffer a broken nose. I should be found guilty of assault. What jury nullification is simply, hey, I don't really care what the law is. I don't care what the judge says. I don't care what the evidence is. I'm not convicting. And you see that happen sometimes in cases where, for example, you could have seen it in the Daniel Penny case, where the Daniel Penny case, all of the jurors could have decided technically, okay, maybe he did disregard. Maybe he failed to see that what he did would have killed the victim. But you know what? He's a hero in my book, and I'm not convicting. That's what jury nullification is. It's when the jury just disregards what the law is, and they vote with their conscience.
Yeah. By the way, this was probably the most horrendous thing I've ever seen. And this is not this case right here. Was the mayor with the accused man who set the woman on fire yesterday on the subway. If you don't know, a guy literally lit a woman who was sleeping. She died from her injuries. But that's just the point, Professor Pituto here. Yeah. It's like, you know, it's a slippery slope because, you know, in my eyes, that guy is equally evil, if not more so. So when do you have these perp walks? When do you televise hearings? Is it a slippery slope?
Well, it certainly could be. And I mean, you can make the argument that the guy yesterday is more dangerous with regard to the public because he's not selecting out some, you know, executive of a big company. He's randomly going after somebody sitting on the subway. If you want to talk about terrorizing the public, that one seems to be much more terrifying to your run-of-the-mill citizen in New York than somebody who picked out a multimillionaire, you know, executive of a big company. I don't know that in that case it will turn out. Doesn't sound to me as though it's going to turn out to be any kind of, you know, intentional or purposeful singling out, trying to make a statement. It sounds like this guy is going to be shown to be really off his, you know, not thinking rationally at all. It is the same subway line that that Penny was on. So,
oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So that, you know, the fact that people think that the subway is dangerous and that there's not enough policing of it, you know, I think certainly that will play into this. But you're right. I mean, why not make a public statement about this person, and we're going to protect our people on the subways, and we're not going to let, you know, the random person on the subway terrorize our citizens. That's the one that's certainly much closer to the citizens in New York than the facts of this.
That's such a great point. Talk about terrorizing. You're absolutely right. For those of us, and I'm one of them, I get around the city by subway. I should now have to worry that I could be sitting there and somebody could randomly light me on fire? That's truly terrorizing.
Yeah.
Where's everybody speaking up on that? Is this defendant going to be charged with first degree murder also?
Yeah. By the way, Randy, is it typical at a hearing like this for the defendant to be in, you know, civilian clothes and not the jumpsuit? I just don't know in New York.
I've seen far more often than not. I mean, unless the family got clothes to the jail in advance. Most times, yeah, you're showing up in your prison outfit. You're not showing up like you're going to Starbucks Reserve for coffee with with your friend who you decided to dress up. We were both going to be matching today.
Yeah. And Randy, you probably know this better than Joe because you're in there every day in New York. But what about the psych evaluation? A lot of people do think that maybe they go with some kind of insanity defense, even though that's going to be incredibly hard. How soon does he get this psych eval? How often? How does that all play?
Well, the judge, for example, in the state case, the judge would order an evaluation pursuant to the criminal procedure law. It's called it's a 730-30 hearing, and that's because that's the statute under the criminal procedure law. But, I mean, as the defense, you're going to make sure that you avail yourself. You look under every rock. You pick up every rock. You never know what you're going to find. But as we talked about a few minutes earlier, it's going to be difficult for Mr. Mangione to have any kind of viable insanity defense where the heart of it is, I could not appreciate the nature and the consequences of my actions. I could not discern right from wrong. I did not know and did not understand that what I was doing was wrong. The planning that went into this, the escape, the purchase of the silencer, the stalking, everything that was done, that manifesto, that book, to me, unless the defense is going to be that there was a voice in my head telling me to do this. There was a dog in my dream instructing me to do this. Short of that, unfortunately for Mr. Mangione, his own planning, his own writing down, memorializing what he was going to do, how he was going to do it, and why he was going to do it, and the steps that he took to avoid detection and evade capture is going to do anything but help him say, hey, I did not understand the difference between right and wrong.
Yeah. This is a great question. If anyone knows the answer, I don't. I haven't heard or did not hear that any members of his family were there. If not Joe Pituto, what, if anything, do you read into that? I mean, they live in the Baltimore area, which is a quick train ride up to Manhattan. What are your thoughts?
I don't know. You know, it was a simple hearing. It was a simple arraignment. If I were charged with first degree murder, my family would be there. But, yeah. You know, family dynamics are different. I think more telling will be who will be at the trial than at arraignment. I mean, there are going to be a lot of these, case hearings going forward. And they might, I have no, you know, I don't know what kept them from there, but I don't think I'd read much into it.
Yeah. By the way, there is a handle on X that is, I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it is heavily supportive of Luigi. And today they were tweeting tears and emoji faces. And when he was in court, OMG, I love this. So, you know, a lot of that going on. And I see it in our own chat where people are saying, free Luigi. I got news for you. It's not going to happen. They're not going to free this guy. They're going to convict him on the evidence. And I think that there is plenty of evidence there, unless there's some issue with mental health that comes up. Let's watch this now. COE, I'm assuming this is different. I'm going to pick this up. If it's the same, I'll stop it. But I assume this is a little bit different from court today.
Your Honor, we have a copy of the indictment, notice of integration consequences, as well as rap sheet. I believe the court has, if we give the court an extra copy and one to counsel. Does the court wish that we be heard with respect to bail?
What is the situation with the federal authorities?
As we understand that we have primary jurisdiction, and we have been informed by the U.S. attorney that they intend on allowing us to try our case first. So with respect to whatever goes on there, as the party with primary jurisdiction, the trial and the sentencing will take place here prior to anything that takes place in the federal system.
So what you just said in the answer is.
So that's D.A. Seidemann. And he was saying, and it is true that the state here, New York State, is going to have the first crack at it. Randy, is that surprising? Usually it's the feds that have kind of the superseding power. So why here is New York going first?
I've been involved in more than a few cases where the Southern District or the Eastern District basically looks at the local prosecutor and says, okay, I'll take that file, please. Thanks very much. Appreciate your help. Take care. So it is not typical for the U.S. Attorney's Office to give leeway or give passage to a local prosecutor to go first. It may be as simple as the Southern District will sit back, and if there's a conviction on first-degree murder, then maybe they don't do anything, but they're there just in case. Just in case there's a problem with the state prosecution, they're ready to jump in. So to me, the more interesting question, and I know that the professor can probably speak and explain it better than I can, but for a lot of people, one of the things that I hear, and maybe I don't hear enough of, is, wait a second. What about double jeopardy? Right. Is it that one person can be tried at the same time by both the state and the feds. And I happen to have learned that because I had one such a case where I had a case out in Suffolk County, and it was being handled by the Suffolk County District Attorney's Office. And then the Southern District came in on the same charges and said, okay, we're here too. And I said, okay, so what? Suffolk's getting out of the way? And they said, no, Suffolk's going forward and we're going forward. And what it came down to is the concept of dual sovereignty, right, where there ain't double jeopardy. And because they are separate sovereigns, the state can do its thing and the feds can do its thing. And you better have a client with a whole hell of a lot of money because you're doing them both at the same time.
Yeah. And I will add to that, the U.S. attorney has a policy about when they will come in and do a prosecution when there's a state prosecution. And you've seen it in some cases. I think one of them, one of the ones that came up on last, it might have been, they do it when there's a substantial federal interest, civil rights, antitrust law, they sometimes do it, but they don't. Their policy is you don't go in unless you have a substantial reason for doing it. The Oklahoma City bomber case from many years ago, the defendant, not McVeigh, but the other one, Terry Nichols. He was prosecuted in federal court, and then the locals also prosecuted him. They came in after the federal prosecution. So it happens at times, but it is not common. And Randy is exactly right. The double jeopardy clause of the U.S. Constitution says the same jurisdiction, whether it's the state or the federal government, can't prosecute somebody twice for the same crime. But it doesn't speak to different jurisdictions being able to prosecute. And the sentences can run consecutive to the other. They don't have to be concurrent. In a case like this, were the state to get a conviction and the U.S. attorney still decide to prosecute, and I agree with Randy, I don't think that's likely. What happens is there is what's called a detainer placed on the person who's in state court, because often they don't do the prosecution then. They may wait until the first sentence runs in course. And of course, if it's life, you know, it's never going to happen. But they can wait until you're being released from the first imprisonment. And then they come in and do the second imprisonment. And you don't get released. You just are handed over to the other jurisdiction so they can do the crime. They can do the prosecution. So it's not unconstitutional. There are a lot of things, by the way, about the double jeopardy clause that in the public mind, the public reads that protection to be much broader than it is, and it's not simply dual sovereigns.
By the way, this is not a legal question, but I remember being a little boy in the late 70s, and I was always terrified to go in to New York City from New Jersey because there'd be these squeegee guys and the women of the night walking the streets. I lived in New York City in the 70s, says Core by the Lake. Seems like the city is heading back that way. Is it, Randy? You live there. Is it going backwards?
It's going backwards. It's dirty. There's an issue of just being hassled and being yelled at and screamed at. And it's unfortunate, homeless people. It's not as bad as San Francisco, but the city is not what it was. And it is unfortunate, and you can say whatever you want about Rudy Giuliani, but when Rudy Giuliani was running the show, the city was a different place. It was, it's not the same.
Yeah. And then Bloomberg was, you know, he ran that with, an iron fist. COE, this is some more, I think, video. I'm going to play this. I'm not sure what this is. Oh, this is the perp walk with some other stuff. But so this is something I need to get both your takes on. There's been some reporting on, Joe, I'll start with you on this, that the healthcare industry, I guess lobbyists for the healthcare industry are really the ones who laid on the feds to make it a federal case. And to me, that's a little frightening because I have a good friend who's a big time lobbyist in D.C. And knowing that he could convince the federal government to charge criminally in this manner, that's where I think we're getting to some really dicey ground, because the healthcare executive, the healthcare industry, they obviously want their executives kept safe. But is it okay for them to lobby or push for a federal indictment? And then, or am I just living in fairyland?
You know, I don't know that it's illicit for somebody to push or urge a prosecution. I mean, think of the cases, Joel, that even you have, where parents of a victim are trying to push the state or the, you know, to go back in and investigate and prosecute. People who have, you know, a significant interest may also have information or reason to say, you know, you're not treating this seriously enough, and let me tell you why. Where I think the rubber hits the road is the decision by the prosecutor to do it, and whether the prosecutor is doing it on valid, supportable, defensible grounds based on the urging of an outside entity or somebody else, or whether the entity has money or political influence or power. So it's not the decision to do it itself, and it's not the fact that somebody with an interest isn't urging it. It's the basis on which, and maybe even the appearance of, the prosecution deciding to go forward that I think can be really troubling.
Hmm. Randy, what do you think about this, if it is in fact true that the industry through,
to me, the timing makes it less likely that the Southern District capitulated to pressure from insurance lobbyists. You've got a new administration coming in January 20th. Joe Biden has made a career, and as recently as what, in the past 24 hours, basically saying, I don't agree with the death penalty. I don't like the death penalty. And I'm commuting every death row inmate who's looking at being executed, save a terrorist. So I think if the insurance industry were concerned that there should be federal jurisdiction, I think they would have waited until January 21st, where they'd have a much more sympathetic ear in President Trump and in President Trump's DOJ. So I don't really see it. I think that the U.S. Attorney's Office made a decision out of, I think, and I don't know that they'd ever admit to it, concerned that the district attorney of New York County is just dealing with a lot of stuff. And they just wanted to make sure. I think that this is a belt and suspenders approach. And the fact that there was an announcement that the Southern District is not taking over the case, to me, really is proof that this was more of a backstop and not pressure from an industry saying you got to jump in, because then they just would have jumped in and taken it over.
Yeah. By the way, Randy is being incredibly generous with his time, and he's on vacation, so I'm going to wrap in just a couple of minutes. Joe also very giving her time. Of course, it is the eve of both Hanukkah and Christmas, which happened to fall on the same day this year, which is unusual. If you appreciate the content, please hit that like button. Please subscribe if you want to become a member. And on the Patreon page, we put all kinds of interesting and weird things in there, from court documents to songs that members of STS Nation send us about Wendy and Donna Adelson. From Roffin Roffer here, it always sounds like a Dr. Seuss name to me. Do you really think 12 jurors are going to convict Luigi? Randy, take that one. In a real life setting, not a hypothetical, in New York City, where there are a lot of liberal people, is a conviction possible with the way things are playing out publicly? Oh, Randy froze. Joe, I'll have you take that.
Yeah, I certainly think it's possible. I mean, if the jurors pay attention to the law and the evidence, they should come back with a conviction based on what I know right now. Is it also possible that one might feel that he's going to take or she's going to take a stand for, you know, no, who knows what, you know, that the insurance industry is bad and they're going to show their dissatisfaction, excuse me, by refusing to convict? Sure, that's also possible. But I think the likelihood is there will be a conviction on the evidence that we have right now.
Randy, to you, someone was asking earlier on about a gag order. It seems appropriate in a case like this where there is so much attention being given to it. How does that work? When would a judge institute a gag order? At what point? Oh, I think you're muted, Randy. You just have to unmute yourself.
Oh, I don't know how that happened. Hold on. Yeah, it says the host is unmuted. Am I good?
You're good. You're good.
I'm sorry. Yeah. No. So, thank you. So I it's very difficult because there are constitutional issues there and the public's right to know. And quite frankly, people's right to speak. So you really have to cross a line in terms of, in a judge's mind, you are out there tainting a potential juror with what we call extrajudicial commentary. We saw the difficulty that the former soon-to-be president-elect Trump had in terms of dealing with gag orders, and we've seen other high-profile cases where there have not been gag orders. I think in this case, what will interest me is whether or not this case is being set up for a plea bargain. With the first-degree murder, Mr. Mangione could be looking at life without the possibility of parole. Federally, he could be looking at the death penalty. So it seems to me that a defense attorney, in the face of what seems like overwhelming evidence of guilt, if you can negotiate a deal for a 26-year-old where he actually could have a shot of getting out of jail when he's in his 50s and being done with it, that's a plea bargain that is worth taking a look at. So I'm not so sure that anybody's running that quickly to a trial. I think by the time this case would come to trial, you're not going to have that same zeal, that same free Luigi. The world could look very different a year or a year and a half from now, and he's not going to be the soup of the day. It's just going to be another case. Remember, we've got Donald Trump coming into office in a couple of weeks. Who the hell knows what we're going to be doing a year or a year and a half from now? So don't be surprised if all of a sudden murder two and 25 to life don't look so bad.
Yeah. By the way, this is true, but I don't think the judge is corrupt. That part is not true. But this judge is married to a former Pfizer executive. I didn't know that it was a lawyer. I thought it was someone in, you know, in the corporate ladder there. But this person is not. This judge is not going to be the judge presiding over either trials. They were just there. A fun fact is only the fifth time since 1910 that the first night of Hanukkah also falls on Christmas Day. The last time this happened was 2005. It also occurred in 1910, 1921, 1959. Look at this. STS Nation always letting us know. Happy Hanukkah and Merry Christmas to everybody. Final thing here, and then we'll get some quick final thoughts. He is being held, Randy, at the same facility as Sean Diddy Combs, which is where Karen Agnifilo's husband goes to meet his client, Sean Diddy Combs. We did a whole show on Rikers because we thought he was going to go to Rikers on the state charges. Is he just there because of the federal charges? Is it easier to keep him there? What do you think?
Well, believe me when I tell you, the Metropolitan Detention Center, where Mr. Mangione is being housed, is not a fun place to be. Judges have written about it recently, so much so where at least one judge said, if this guy is going to end up going to the Metropolitan Detention Center, I am not sentencing him to jail time. That's how bad the conditions are in the Metropolitan Detention Center. It is the Rikers of federal custodial facilities. So it is not the country club. It is not the camp that many federal clients get to enjoy. It is a cold, depressing, dangerous, dark, and I'll say dangerous again, place to be.
By the way, a quick programming note. We are going to be off lives after tomorrow night, 5 p.m. will be our final live for a few days. And sound the calm alarm. My mother will be here. We're doing a look back at the top true crime stories of 2024. And Carm will give us her take on everyone from Rex Heuerman to Lori Vallow, and the list goes on, and to Luigi. She'll give us her take on all that. Steve Cohen is going to join in. Please tune into that, 5 p.m. Eastern time tomorrow. Huge thanks again to the professor, Joe Petuto, professor emerita at the University of Nebraska. He's taught in many, many fine law schools around the nation, and is now sort of enjoying retirement, even though she still works quite a bit. Joe, your final thoughts on this, and I think Randy brings up a good point that probably a very good chance that there will be some sort of plea here, I would think.
I'll defer to him. I'm just wondering whether the New York DA is going to want to plead out in a case like this, certainly if it's still Bragg, who seems to me, and I don't know him, who enjoys the spotlight of these big cases, seems a little less likely to me that he's going to be willing to do that rather than take it to trial. But, you know, I don't know. My final thoughts really are, we're coming to the end of the year. We're going to be starting a new year. And my hope is that, you know, everyone who watches these programs, the families of the victims, the victims themselves in the cases in which it hasn't been, you know, a murder, that everybody gets a little peace and, you know, family time and time with friends at the end of the season. And that next year we can maybe just tone down the volume a little and being willing to credit that somebody with whom we may disagree emphatically also may have maybe acting out of good faith and may have good reasons, even though we don't agree with them. Because I think this repetition of people shouting at each other and not being willing to listen or to credit other people with having good motives is just somewhere that I think we really need to try to get a handle on and stop. And hopefully everybody's resolutions next year might be to try to help to accomplish that. So that's my thought.
Very, very well said. By the way, Randy said we don't know where we'll be a year from now. We are going to air a show while we're away. This is actually fascinating. I thought it was kind of funny at first, but if you recall, in April of 2023, there was a family in Las Vegas that called 911. Police themselves were very rattled, claiming that they saw 8 to 10 foot aliens on their lawn. Well, a crime scene reconstruction expert, Scott Roeder, who did the Oscar Pistorius case. He does a lot of big cases. He reconstructed the scene frame by frame with the video they have. And let's put it this way. We might not be alone, so we might have bigger things to worry about. But check out the show when it airs. There's another podcaster who joined him who's been studying it. And it's actually really interesting. It was pretty fast.
Well, that might be the best way for us to get along better with each other. We're always much better off when we've got a common enemy or a real common problem out there.
Yeah, 100%. By the way, I mean, not to make light of it, but after 9/11, and Randy knows this, New York City was a different place. We were all coming together, not being divisive, but hopefully it does not take another terror attack for that. Randy Zelin is a very formidable criminal defense attorney. I would have called him, not Mark Agnifilo, if I was Diddy, but that's just me. And he is also a former prosecutor. He does all the TV shows. Very, very smart guy, and he knows the law and a good guy. Your final thoughts, Randy, as we head into the holiday season.
There is little that I can say that was as eloquent and as I think timely as what the professor had to say. I'll just simply add, there's a reason why God gave us two ears and one mouth.
Should have given us 10 years.
Exactly.
And maybe I'll say this. Why don't we work on giving the aliens a reason to want to come here, as opposed to looking down and saying, this ain't a place for us, and moving on.
By the way, they did say that they may have had cloaking devices to keep themselves hidden. So they should come here uncloaked. They should be feel free enough. Maybe they're too scared of what's going on here in the world, America and elsewhere. Love you, America. Love you, Florida. Love you, New Jersey, my home state. And, of course, everyone from the Republic of Ireland, the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and everywhere in between. The COE letting me know there will be giveaways on tomorrow's show, announced live during tomorrow's show, 5 o'clock. I'm sure I'll be arguing with Carm a little bit. Carm keeps calling me. Send me more information on such and such, whoever the defendant was, and then I have to promptly send it to her. She's already worried she can't get on Barnyard, which is what she calls StreamYard. She thinks it's actually called Barnyard. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody.